Hi, this is Alan Side, founder of Cascadia Workshops and the Black Belt Communication Skills Coaching Program. I work with people who are committed to making the world a better place and themselves better people. And I give them the tools, the skills, and the coaching so that they can make the biggest difference possible and manifest the life of their dreams. In this video, I'm going to teach you the five obstacles to effective communication skills. Effective communication skills allow us to create a high quality of connection, out of which people spontaneously choose to contribute to one another's well-being, and out of which conflicts tend to dissolve themselves. So these are the five characteristics of life alienated, life disconnected thinking and language. So the thinking and language that most gets in the way of the high quality of connection that we're looking for that leads to these mutually agreeable win-win outcomes. In the next video, I'll be teaching you the most overlooked insight to how to prevent and resolve misunderstandings and conflicts in any relationship, personal or professional. In the video after that, I'll be giving you the framework or the roadmap, the model for high-level communication skills, as well as the three essential ingredients for developing mastery. When I was in my teens, I had a couple of life-changing experiences that led me to realize that the world was in trouble and that I could choose to be part of the solution or part of the problem. I chose to be part of the solution and then quickly realized that it wasn't enough to preach or sermonize. I had to walk my talk. I had to lead by example. And so that led me at the young age of 16 or 17 to commit to researching best practices in ways to live in harmony with the planet, with each other, and within ourselves. Now, this was before the internet, so that's really when my research began. Since then, I've studied innumerable tools, processes, methodologies, and I just love so many of them, and I've become a really good filter for my audience in terms of what are some high-caliber tools that are most effective in different types of situations. In terms of the interpersonal realm, the process that I teach is a process called nonviolent communication. It was called nonviolent communication because the man who started it, Marshall Rosenberg, he wanted to align himself with Gandhi's movement of nonviolence. However, in Hindi, they had actual words for what they meant. One of those words, satyagraha, roughly translates into soul force, soul truth, or the power of the truth. The other word, ahimsa, roughly translates into I am not your enemy, or loving kindness toward all beings. So we took these two concepts, the power of the truth and loving kindness, and in English we called it nonviolence. So unfortunately, it doesn't tell people what it is, it tells people what it's not, but there's a lot of depth actually to the movement that Dr. Rosenberg was trying to align himself with, is why he called the process nonviolent communication. I've been studying this process since 1995, and I began to teach it and actually was able to do my first mediation with it in 1998. In 1999, I attended a 10-day intensive and immediately spent 10 days with Dr. Rosenberg in Bogota, Colombia, South America, as his Spanish interpreter. I think I learned more in that 10 days than in the previous 4 years of studying it. And it was that year, 1999, that I was asked to become a certified trainer, which I completed in 2003. So I've been a certified trainer since then and have had clients in the academic sector, the nonprofit sector, the government sector, and the business sector, and have seen incredible results in teams, in groups, in individuals' ability to be leaders, and in individuals' abilities to be self-connected, to connect with themselves, and then be able to express that clarity, even if it was very intense, but still without blaming, without judging, without criticizing. So with a lot of power, a lot of clarity, and a lot of compassion. My background is in sustainability, ecological sustainability, and I realized very early on in studying this process that we would be much more effective at addressing big issues like species extinction or climate change if we have strong and powerful collaboration and cooperation tools and skills. And having studied this material for as long as I have, I've been able to transform every significant relationship in my life, both personal and professional. when we're committed to making a difference in the world, to creating positive change, we realize that that always involves other people. It's very, very rare that one person goes out and does something on their own without having other people get on board with the vision or without helping other people maybe see a different perspective. And so this process really is about how to speak your truth, how to share your perspective in a way that's most likely to result in a compassionate understanding from the other person, that's most likely to result in your own needs being met in a way that's in harmony with other people's needs. And also how to listen, how to be tuned into what other people have to say that might be very hard to hear, like a verbal attack or blame, judgment, criticism. How to tune into that in a way that we're actually hearing the other person's feelings and values, what's important to them. In other words, what's in their heart. And therefore, we don't get bent out of shape. We don't get flustered or knocked off our center. And we're able to show up in a more powerful and more compassionate way. And still be able to come back with our own authenticity and our own perspective in a way that's most likely to lead to us being heard the way we want to be heard. And it's this dance of communication that leads us to mutual understanding and win-win outcomes. With high-level communication skills, I can enter any situation and feel this unshakable confidence that if there's a conflict, if there's a misunderstanding, I can handle it. And also, I don't hold back my truth anymore. I used to actually put a little bit of a clamp on my honesty or sort of censor it a little bit because I was afraid of conflict. And this is really very common. And what's underneath that fear of conflict is actually valuing harmony. So I valued harmony, but the way I went about it is it was at the expense of my own honesty. Well, the reverse is also true very often, where people are committed to being honest, to being authentic, to being truthful, but they do it in such a way that turns other people off. And so with high-level communication skills, we can actually have both authenticity and truthfulness, as well as harmony and connection with others, which leads to a sense of community, which is one of the things most lacking in our world at this time. So what I'd like to do is just dive into the content right now and share with you these five elements that most get in the way of the quality of connection that we're looking for, and they get in the way of high-level communication skills, and they lead to possibly creating damage in our relationships without us even realizing it. The first of these five elements that disconnect us from other people is diagnoses. Now, I'm not talking about valid medical diagnoses. I'm talking about a type of thinking and language that puts other people in a box or pigeonholes them. Now, this includes criticism and judgments and name-calling and pigeonholing, and very often it includes static language. Nonviolent communication is a process language, and this life-disconnected communication is a static language, so the verb to be is very important. For example, he is a jerk, or she is very unreasonable. So the verb to be is sort of static, and it implies that somebody just is that and they don't change. So that's the first element, is diagnoses. Now, it's not limited to name calling and criticizing. It's anytime we think we know what's going on inside the other person. Like, for example, hey, you over there, when you yelled at me for no reason whatsoever. So when I'm saying that to someone, when you yelled at me for no reason whatsoever, I'm implying that I know what was going on inside them and that they had no reason for doing that. So that's a form of diagnosing. Or, for example, if I say to somebody, well, I can see you're very angry. And the person might say, I'm not angry, I'm just frustrated. Or I'm just feeling a lot of disappointment. But as soon as we say that, well, I can see you're very angry, it automatically creates a disconnection because none of us like to be told what's going on inside us, like the other person knows what's going on inside us, especially if that's not what's going on. So it creates a disconnection. Now I can check it out with the other person and I can say, are you feeling angry right now? Later on, as we go deeper, I'll help you connect that with the need or the value and go even deeper and create a high quality of connection. But for now, just know that we can check things out with people. We don't have to diagnose them and tell them what's going on. The second element of this thinking and language that gets in the way of the kind of connection that we're looking for is denial of responsibility. Now, denial of responsibility is any thinking and language that implies that we don't have choice. Now, we may not like the options that we're aware of, but within that, we always have choice. Examples of denial of responsibility are really everywhere. I've seen a grown man say to a young child, "Don't make me hit you." Things like that, like, "Don't make me hit you." How could this child make you do anything? Other examples, a policeman saying to somebody they pulled over, "Well, I have to give you a ticket. It's the law." Rather than, "I'm choosing to give you a ticket because I have an agreement with my employer that I'm choosing to be of integrity with." Or, "I'm choosing to give you a ticket because I saw you doing 80 in a 20 and I value safety, so I'm choosing to give you a ticket." Here's another example. "It hurts, mommy, when you don't make your bed." Rather than saying what's important to me about the bed being made. So for example, when you make your bed, it contributes to my needs for order and beauty. Or, "There are certain things that I want you to learn, honey, when you live in a household with other people, and making your bed is part of that." Rather than, "It hurts me when you don't do it." So it hurts me, so pack your bags, we're going on a guilt trip. You know, that kind of thing. It's avoiding responsibility to say, "It hurts me when." Another example. "I have no choice. I have to give you grades. It's school policy." Rather than saying, "The value that I see in giving grades." Or, "I'm choosing to give you grades because I'm choosing to keep my job." So it's really everywhere. Now, there's a famous, infamous, let's call him, Nazi war criminal who was indicted after World War II for war crimes. His name was Adolf Eichmann, and he was interviewed before his court appearance, and his interviewer asked him, "Was it difficult for you to send tens of thousands of people to the gas chambers?" And Adolf Eichmann said, "No, actually, it was easy. Our language made it easy." And we even had a name for that language. We called it Amtssprache. So in German, that roughly translates into bureaucraties or office talk. So you see this bureaucraties everywhere, and it's a way of avoiding responsibility. I have no choice. It's the policy. I have to do it. It's superior's orders. So when you start noticing this denial of responsibility, you start to see that it's everywhere. "You give me no choice. I have to do X." Rather than, "I choose to do X because." So here's a little exercise that you can do in your own time, which is to take a notebook, maybe a pad of paper, you take your sheet of paper, and you draw a line down the middle. And on one side, you're going to write, "I have to blank. I have to blank" on each line. And then fill in the blank of what it is that you tell yourself that you have to do. Then on the other side, for each one of those have to's, you're going to write, "I choose to blank because blank." And see what happens. So, "I have to go to work. I have to take the kids to school. I have to cook dinner. I have to show up at this meeting." And then, "I choose to. I choose to show up at this meeting because." And then you really get to connect with yourself. Well, why? If I really don't want to go, why am I choosing? Is it acceptance? I'm concerned about what people will think of me if I don't go? And be really honest with yourself. You can do this little exercise in the privacy of your own kitchen table and really examine all the things that you're telling yourself you have to do, and then get connected to, why is it that you're actually choosing to do them? I was in a friend's house when we were discussing this idea that we always have choice and there's never anything that we have to do. And he said, "But Alan, I have to do the dishes." We were hanging out in his kitchen and there was a stack of dirty dishes behind me. He said, "I have to do the dishes." I said, "Really? Why don't you throw them out and buy new ones? Or you could choose to eat off of dirty plates. Or why don't you go out and buy some paper plates?" The point being that we have more options than we're aware of, but here's really the important piece, is that if I'm doing the dishes out of an energy of "I have to," I should. If I don't do it, nobody else will. I could be resenting the task and resenting other people in relation to that task. And I'm creating a lot of tension in my body and in my mind in relation to that. Rather than, as opposed to, doing the dishes because I'm connected to how it contributes to my needs, how it serves life to do the dishes. So I'm doing the dishes because it contributes to my values around health and hygiene. Or I'm doing the dishes because it contributes to my need for order and cleanliness. Or I'm doing the dishes because I'm connected to something very important to me, which is to be a contributing member of the community that is my household. And so when I'm doing the dishes with those energies, because I'm connected to how it meets my needs, and how it contributes to life, that's a very different energy than doing the dishes out of I should, I have to, if I don't do it, nobody else will. And it's less likely that I'll be resenting it if I'm really connected to why I'm doing the dishes. So just to give you an example, in my home, my wife, Trisha, and I, we have an understanding that we don't do anything for each other out of the following energies. And this is the third component of, the third element of the thinking and language that gets in the way of the quality of connection we're wanting. Now, we can call this list coercion, or we can call it life alienating, life disconnected motivations. And here it is: fear, guilt, shame, duty and obligation, to get a reward, to avoid punishment, out of shoulds or have to's. So my wife Trisha and I have an understanding that we don't do anything for each other out of those energies. If you get anything out of this whole video and you only remember one thing, it would be this. The energy with which we do anything for each other is just as important as the thing itself. The energy with which we do anything for each other is just as important as the action itself. So for example, if you said, Alan, would you bring me a glass of water, please? And I stomp off and I come back and there's your darn water, and I slam it down, and then I give you the cold shoulder for 2 days. Well, you would have gotten me to do what you wanted, but is it really worth it in the relationship? When you notice the energy that I'm bringing you your water with, you might have chosen to say, oh, Alan, never mind, I'll get my own water. Or it's okay, I'll ask somebody else to do it. Because sometimes we get the thing we want, but we pay a big price. So anytime anyone does anything for us out of fear, guilt, shame, duty and obligation, reward, punishment, out of shoulds or have-tos, the relationship pays a big price. So please don't do anything for anyone else in your life out of those energies, and don't accept a yes from anybody in your life if they're going to do it out of those energies. Going back to the agreement that my wife and I have is that we don't do anything for each other out of those energies. So if I'm doing the dishes, but I'm resenting her out of the fact that I'm doing the dishes, she would rather I not do the dishes. If she's vacuuming and she's resenting me out of the fact that she's vacuuming, I would rather she not vacuum. Because what's more important, the dishes or the relationship? What's more important, the vacuuming or the relationship? So the dishes still get done, the vacuuming still gets done, but it happens when we're connected to how it serves. There have actually been a few times in the last year, year and a half, that I've gone to bed with the kitchen just a total mess, and I've gone to bed with a smile on my face, really grateful that nobody did any kitchen cleanup out of an energy that any of us was going to pay for later because of resentment and sort of holding a grudge. So this is the third element, is these life disconnecting motivations. The fourth element that most gets in the way of the high quality of connection we're looking for, I would call demands. So in nonviolent communication, it's perfectly okay to ask people to do what it is we want them to do. But we recognize that the energy with which they do it is just as important as the action itself. So we make a request. Please would you get me a glass of water, but only if you can do it with the joy of a small child feeding a hungry duck. Could you get me a glass of water only if it also meets your needs? So please only do that thing that I'm asking you to do if you can do it with some enjoyment and knowing that it's also contributing to your own needs. Otherwise, please, I'd rather do it myself or have somebody else do it. So in life-disconnected communication, we don't care the energy that the other person does it with. It's okay to motivate people in life-disconnected communication. It's okay to motivate people out of fear, guilt, shame, duty, and obligation, to get a reward, to avoid punishment, and out of shoulds and have-tos. So in life-disconnected communication, I don't care. I just want the thing done, darn it. So it's my way or the highway. That's a demand. By definition, in a demand, your needs don't matter to me equally to my own needs. However, in a request, in a true request, the other person's needs matter to me equally to my own needs. So if the thing I've requested doesn't quite work for them, then I'm willing to, you know, find out what would work for them. So I'm willing to listen to their needs, and I'm willing to kind of find that mutually agreeable outcome, that win-win. So in a request, I'm able to hear a no with as much love as a yes. So that's demands. That's the fourth one. The fifth one is the concept of deserve. Now, deserve is also known as justification of reward and punishment. This element goes very deep in our culture, actually, because we have something that theologian Walter Wink called the myth of redemptive violence. The myth of redemptive violence states that some people become better human beings by having violence done unto them. And when you look at our criminal justice system, you notice that what we have is a system of punitive justice, as opposed to restorative justice. So restorative justice actually restores the community. It restores the wrongs that were done. It restores the individuals. Punitive justice, the word punitive is based on the same root of the word to punish. So there's a reason why we call our prisons penitentiaries. And it's because that's where we send people to do penance. The theory behind that is that the more I think that I'm worthless and don't deserve anything good in my life, the more I think that I'm a piece of CRAP, I want to keep this family friendly, then the better I'll come out at the end. The more I think I'm worth nothing, the better I'll come out in the end. I wouldn't have a problem with that if it actually worked. If you look at the statistics around our criminal justice system and the rate of recidivism, that's the revolving door, people who leave prison who end up back in, that's over 60%. So we're not actually transforming people. We're just creating a system of punishment that doesn't actually help anybody. We're spending a ton of money per inmate per year and really not helping anybody transform or become a better human being. Restorative justice, on the other hand, is a very, very, very powerful philosophy and set of methodologies that has a lot of promise for working much better. So the concept of deserve is the idea that, now going back to diagnoses, where we use static language, some people are good and some people are bad, and those who are bad deserve to be punished. That's the idea behind punitive justice and this concept of deserve, justification of reward and punishment. The poet Rumi has a couple of lines in which he says, "Beyond ideas of rightness and wrongness, there is a field. I'll meet you there." And that's some of the flavor of nonviolent communication. And another way of thinking about it is, all over the world, in every culture, people are playing one of two games. One of those is called, who's right and who's wrong? And the other game is called, how can I make life more wonderful? That gives you some of that flavor of nonviolent communication. So life disconnected, life alienated thinking and language is that game of who's right and who's wrong, and therefore who deserves to be punished. If you want to see a really good example of punitive justice and the myth of redemptive violence, I invite you to check out Saturday morning cartoons. Children's cartoons usually have the good guys and the bad guys, and at the climax of the show, the bad guys are humiliated, punished, obliterated, turned into dust. And the good guys are celebrated, rewarded, accepted for having humiliated, pulverized, killed the bad guys. These are the five elements of life disconnected communication and language. Diagnoses, denial of responsibility, life disconnected motivations, demands, and the concept of deserve. Once we see those clearly, then really a lot of other things open up. It's sort of like looking through a window and you're not seeing clearly and you start to clean the window and you're wiping off the grime that got in the way of seeing clearly. I remember when I used to work with couples a lot, I had one couple come to me, and one of the things I would do is a mini introduction to nonviolent communication before I would have them start to speak with each other. And when I got through this particular piece of life disconnected, life alienated communication, they both looked at each other and laughed. And I thought, what's going on? And I asked them, what was that about? And they said, well, Alan, you just solved about half of our problems just with this piece of these five elements that get in the way of the quality of connection we're looking for. In the next two videos, we're going to take it even further, because now that we're really clear about what it is that's not going to meet our needs, in the next video, we'll look at what's the most overlooked insight for preventing and resolving miscommunications and conflicts. What I want to invite you to do right now is to commit for the next 24 hours. Now, if you're really hardcore, we'll say 48 hours, to really tune your awareness to notice throughout your day, when are you hearing diagnoses, denial of responsibility, these energies that we called coercion or life disconnected motivations, demands, justification of reward and punishment. Just tune into that in the world around you, when you listen to the radio, when you're overhearing a conversation in the grocery store, when you are noticing your own thoughts and your own thinking. Just tune in to noticing that in the world around you, because it's going to be a little bit more glaring, I think, after this video. What high-level communication skills have helped me do in social change situations is really get heard in the way I wanted to be heard. Bring what I wanted to bring to that group in a way that it was most likely to be received. Receive difficult to deal with people in a way that it didn't really impact me negatively so much as created an opportunity for mutual understanding, connection, and a mutually agreeable outcome. I've taken people who I otherwise might have labeled as enemies or people that I would never be able to connect with, and I've transformed those relationships and really forged alliances with people with very different worldviews and perspectives, because my communication skills were able to build a bridge so that we no longer saw each other as enemies. We're able to see where there was some common ground in our perspective and work from there. Without high-level communication skills, what could we possibly accomplish? I hope that, like me, you're done with poor meeting process. You're done with this adversarial sort of energy among people who are working together or ought to be working together to make the world a better place. I hope that you're done with the dysfunctionality that happens in so many of the movements that want to create a positive future for everybody. And I hope that you can join me in the next video, where we'll look at the most overlooked insight for preventing and resolving misunderstandings and conflicts so that we can continue this journey together with high-level communication skills. What I want you to do next is go below this video and enter a comment. Give me some feedback. Tell me the most important takeaway for you from this video. And if there's anything you didn't like, go ahead and put that too. I really appreciate you watching for this long, and I really appreciate you in my life and that you chose to give me this time and for us to spend this time together. So please leave me a comment below, and I look forward to seeing you on the next video.